Hello and welcome to the PCF Bank half-year results call. Throughout the call, all participants will be in listen-only mode. And just to remind you, this call is being recorded. Today, I'm pleased to present Scott Mabry, the Chief Executive Officer, Robert Murray, the Managing Director, and David Bull, the Finance Director. Please go ahead with your meeting.
Good morning, everyone, and this is Scott Mabry speaking. Thank you for joining us and taking the time to hear of our results this morning. Would have been good to, of course, meet up in person. Actually, it would have been good to meet anyone at the moment, but we'll try it this way, and hopefully it will be informational for you and provide some good support to the statement we've already put out this morning. Alongside that statement, you will have seen a presentation on our website, and hopefully everyone's got access to that, and that will be the document that we'll be using to take you through today. Just to open up, I think the statement is very much about two very distinctive parts to our half one results. We were progressing quite well up to the point of the pandemic. As you will see, the new business volumes were strong. Our portfolio growth was strong as well. We were tracking towards targets as well as far as profitability. So it's a little bit disappointing to be blown off course by the external events, which have hit not just us, but all companies and banks, but the UK more generally. But I guess what's most important is how you respond to those things. So we want to give you reassurance today that we've proven operationally resilient post the crisis, and put in place very quickly and effectively the controls and processes that you would need to operate in this environment. I think over the course of the next half hour, we'll cover those areas, and we'll open up for questions at the end of that. I think the headlines really for us are just to will be to highlight the profitability, the underlying profitability, speak in detail about COVID-19 and impairment effects, and then also, as I said, be reassurance on liquidity and capital going forward. David Bull will take the question on operational highlights and financial highlights, and he'll also take any points on IFRS 9, which has its own specific slide. Robert will take you through operational resilience as well as business lines and how they were building quite nicely pre-COVID, and then returning to myself to actually finish up with some summary and strategic comments. So I think without any further ado, let's hand over to David, and he can take from page 5 through the operational highlights.
Morning, and yes, it's David here. So I'll go through the operational highlights to begin with. As mentioned, our new business originations were going well, up 26% to 153 million. I think probably the last 2 weeks in March saw a decline as we went into lockdown, but it was good first 6 months for originations, and the portfolio growth due to those originations increased by 18% to 401 million. And you'll see a breakdown of that in further slides. Retail deposits supporting that growth of 340 million. We also have the term funding scheme with 25 million. And indeed, we've got the ability to draw further on the TFSME facility that the Bank of England offered up for banks. We have a diversified asset-backed lending portfolio. And I think the next point, the operational resilience, we have been testing ourselves in terms of continuity plans and DR plans over the course of the last 2 or 3 years. and it was testament to those plans that we were able to 100% work from home within a couple of days of making that decision. So a testament to our IT teams, but also our resilient plans that we'd put together. Originations are 80% of those are prime customers. Again, that's reinforcing our strategy of going more prime, and our growth is in that prime area. Our impairment charge, our cost of risk is 1.7%, and I'll come on to that in a later slide. 138 million of our book is forborne at this stage, 34% of the total book. Fair to say that there's about 50% of it, 50% of the business finance book is forborne, about 22% of the customer individual personal finance book was forborne. So if I move on to financial highlights, looking at the underlying profit, that's up 27%, so if we exclude the COVID-19 impairment charge, to 4.2 million, but the true number, of course, is the 2.6 million, which is down 21% on last year's 6 months. Operating income up 26% to 12.7 million. Net interest margin is down to 6.8%, and that is really our strategy of moving prime. It is our strategy, and I think we've signalled that will come down. And of course, part of that income is early settlements, and early settlements is probably not something that customers are doing now because of the pandemic. Cost to income is encouragingly coming down, 52.4%. I'd imagine that will stay put as second half growth is likely to be limited, as our volumes are about half of what we predict. Return on assets down 48% to 1.4%, again largely due to that COVID impairment, and return on equity at 6.8%. So if I move on to my third slide, the IFRS 9 loan loss impairment, I've tried to reflect the changes that have been brought about by COVID. So if we hadn't had the effects of the pandemic, our portfolio would have been at the cost of risk would have been about 80 basis points, but with the effects of COVID-19, 170 basis points. We had seen a little bit of stress and a less benign environment in the SME book, but nothing untoward, but that was a slight increase in previous period. So the areas of focus when we looked at IFRS 9 and what brought about by the COVID-19 is looking at our base macroeconomic curves. The short, medium-term view is severely impacted. The likes of OBR and other forecasters in the market were showing deep changes to the curve, be it significant increases in unemployment or reduction in GDP. The third important one was used car indexed price index, which is again something that we use to model our book. We did also increase our pessimistic weighting, and we showed that in more detail our annual accounts, but that pessimistic weighting has increased due to our outlook view of the market. And in the areas that our model, which is the model is very good in terms of it understands based on our curve the future, and then it looks at what's happened in terms of the past. But of course, it can't predict that 34% of our book was forborne. Certain sectors are going into stress, and particular ones that we identified was the broadcast and media industry and the audio, visual and photography loans that we have. And so we drew those out, as well as the falling asset values in second-hand car prices, for example, and the market becoming less liquid. So look, bringing those ideas and those additional model adjustments to the IFRS 9 calculation, it did increase our probability of defaults, which has had the effect of changing some of our book from stage one to stage two. Forgive me for the technicality of this and happy to answer questions later on. Also, in terms of recovery rates dropping, that does increase the loss given default. And the net effect of that is the overall expected credit loss provision increased by 27% to 2.8% of our lending book. What's going to happen in the next six months is very difficult to predict. One would say that when the forborne loans, for example, start to come back to being paid, which is likely probably in September and later, we will truly know how it's affected those customers. I'll leave it at that point, and perhaps there will be some questions later and I can answer those. But if I can now hand over to Robert Murray to do slide 8 and onwards.
Thank you, David. Good morning to everybody. What I was going to do was sort of cover three things from an operational basis and predominantly focused on the lending side of the business, which was to talk you through H1 performance, what the impacts were on us, particularly on the lending side of the business as a result of COVID-19 in mid-March and onwards, and also what trends we're seeing both during H1, but I guess more particularly over the last 2 months since we've started to see the impacts of COVID-19. So the first slide here is just a real very simplistic picture of our business model, the two sides to the balance sheet, funding and lending. On the funding side, you'll see that 92% of our money comes in via deposits. We'd seen growth during H1. Post 31 March, we've not really had much need to access the markets because of the drop in lending volumes. But when we have had to go into the market, we found it largely unchanged and quite easy to access deposits as and when we need them. So we feel comfortable on that front in terms of availability of funds as and when we need them. On the lending side, you'll see there that over 50% of the portfolio is business finance. That's actually trending in a downwards direction. So at the finals, at September 19, it was 54%, and the previous year it was 55%. And that's really a factor of a slowdown in growth of business finance and an uptick in growth, particularly in consumer finance, which I'll come on to later. And a trend that we will probably see in the full year results is bridging finance, having an increasing share of the portfolio. On the next slide, we talk about the COVID-19 impact and how we've dealt with it. So I think Scott and David already mentioned that we've had business continuity plans in place for, well, since 9/11, but certainly as a bank, they've been increased to a far higher level. And we test those plans on a fairly regular basis. So I think 2 weeks before COVID-19, we had our collections team working from home for 2 days. And that worked satisfactorily. And we find out where we can improve our remote working. But it put us in a position when the initial lockdown started on the 17th of March that we could start having staff work from home. And by the following Monday on the 23rd, the entire workforce was working from home. And it's worked very effectively. And as David said, our IT department have done a fantastic job, enabling us to remain open in all of our business segments, whether it's savings or any of the different lending divisions. We made use of the government's furlough scheme, particularly in sales and sales support, and it, even more particularly at Azul, which is effectively a sales unit for us. Although we do write some of that business on our own book, it's a sales machine. And then progressively over the last 2 months, we've furloughed further staff as and when we felt it necessary. Capital liquidity has been a focus for the board from the immediate start of the crisis. We've had weekly meetings to review both our capital and our liquidity position. We feel very comfortable with where we stand at the moment. We're well above where we would like to be, both in terms of our TCR and our LCR. We have availability on the Tier 2 facility, and we also, as David mentioned, have access to the TFSME funding scheme, which will give us further liquidity going forward. I guess the key areas to discuss, though, are how COVID has affected both our lending and forbearance. So on the lending side, we saw an immediate drop-off in demand, most severely hit at Azul, it probably because of social distancing and people cancelling TV filming and concerts. It had the impact most dramatically. And then progressively, we've seen an uptick, but the uptick has been more obvious in consumer motor finance and bridging finance. I'll come on to those in more detail. And then what we've done in terms of lending is obviously had a flight for quality. So we've been progressively tightening our lending terms over the last 2 months. We've upped our targets for credit quality from 75 to 90% in our prime credit grades, and we're in fact tightening those even further during June. So I think a clear message to everybody that we're focusing on top quality business now. In terms of forbearance, you've got stats there as to which areas have been most affected, and in particular it's been Azul and Ad Business Finance. During the course of the crisis, we improved our processes through increased automation. We started to get a handful of requests very early on in March, maybe the second or third week in March. By the middle of April, it progressed to quite a constant stream of requests. And we improved all of our processes, redeployed staff, and thankfully we were able to be on top of the situation before the end of May and have no sort of outstanding requests. During the April-May period, we had sort of fluctuations in arrears with customers going into arrears but then asking for forbearance, and we've only really seen a true picture of how the portfolio has performed during that two-month period. But effectively, at 31 May, our arrears statistics have regularised, and certainly the percentage of up-to-date accounts is back where it was pre-COVID. The only caveat to that, obviously, is that we have a significant portion of our portfolio which is forborne, and the big question mark is how many of those can see through the next 3 to 6 months. Sadly, I can't give you the answer to that. If we then move on to the next slide and we just talk about new business originations across the group, you'll see from this slide that the real growth over H1 has come from consumer motor finance, which was up 48% to 43 million. And this was on the back of something which we've mentioned in previous presentations about launching an automated prime proposition in our consumer motor finance division, where we had real speed of decision making. So if you drill down into the numbers for H1, what you'll actually see is that consumer finance went from 18 million in Q1 to 25 million in Q2, whereas business finance dropped from 38 million in H1 to 28 million in H2. And I think going back to the original slide that I started off on with the mix of our portfolio, I think what that's going to show as a trend going forward is that consumer finance is going to grow and business, as a percentage of our portfolio, and business finance is going to reduce. And as I'll come on to shortly, I think we'll see bridging finance grow materially as well. So the next slide is on business finance volumes. They were up 16%, 66 million. we've seen growth, as you can see on the chart, over the last 3 years, but that's probably starting to, the growth rate will drop, and certainly over the last 2 months, we haven't seen a flood of opportunities in the business finance market. Consumer finance is, as I said, starting to see some real growth. The prime proposition has proved to be a success. We've developed some real momentum during February and March. And although we had a drop-off in immediately in March and early April in proposal levels, we've seen that increase over the last 6 weeks. And clearly, there's more demand for consumer motor finance in the current climate than there is business finance. Azul, as I mentioned, was most affected. The immediate impact. Its business in the first half of our year is typically quite low anyway because it's a seasonal product. There's not much filming goes on during the winter months because of the lack of daylight hours. But on the other hand, as you would expect to see, this time of the year is being its busiest and it's without doubt its most quiet at the moment. So don't see a huge amount of opportunity in Azul in the current climate. And the one area, turning to my final slide, is bridging finance, which had a good first 6 months, but has really been able to take advantage of market conditions since COVID impacted the economy, insofar as a number of the non-bank lenders in the bridging market have withdrawn because of liquidity issues, or they have investors that just want to revert back to cash and have their positions liquidated as quickly as possible. So it's created a raft of opportunities for us at a time when we had also in January recruited an experienced business development manager to join our team. So in addition to seeing an uptick in February and March in new business within the bridging division, we've seen continued growth during April and May and would expect that to continue in June, and feel that we're now starting to establish a good foothold in that market. So I think that covers my area, and I'll hand you back to Scott to round off.
Great. Thank you, David and Robert. I'm on to page 15. With COVID, the effect of COVID and the pandemic, it's sometimes easy to forget about achievements, but there were certainly plenty of them in the first half leading up to the disruption. As you've seen from David, the underlying profitability was strong and we're tracking towards our previously ambitious targets. It will take some time to rebuild that momentum, but we shouldn't forget that we were on track and performing strongly up to that point. We've seen continued growth, as Robert's taking you through each of the business lines, and our focus on the prime segment has been reinforced, and more than 74% of our total book is in prime now, having really increased our penetration into the prime sector since becoming a bank in 2017. Strong growth you've heard in bridging, a very successful launch of our automated consumer motor product. We've spoken at length in the past about that, but seeing the model proven, seeing the success and momentum we've built up, that is ready to go as soon as we see a return in economic activity in the UK. And we have shown that through scale, the operational gearing of the business has delivered a lower cost-to-income ratio. All the time we've been investing in people and systems and infrastructure, such as the automation of consumer motor, and not stopping the spend in any of those investment areas. On page 16, very much our focus at the moment is around the well-being of our staff, looking after our customers, both whether they need to borrow money at the moment or whether that be assistance in forbearance and really protecting the capital and shareholder value of the business. So our strategic plans and targets that we previously announced, largely on hold, I would guess, at the moment, we'll reset those targets and we'll refocus those strategies as we move through the course of this year. And we have some sort of idea about how this pandemic's going to play out and have some sort of certainty on as and when the UK starts to go through some form of recovery. So at the moment, it's about resilience and minimising the impact of COVID-19. As Robert said, we're open for business across all business lines. Our systems allow us to do that. We've tightened credit terms across all business lines as well, which is only sensible from both a capital preservation point of view, but also not knowing how deep this recession should be, it makes absolute sense to take just the best quality business while continuing to support the UK consumer and the UK SME. We will take the knowledge that we've gained from building an automated consumer motor product and push on with building a market-leading portal for SME lending. Robert identified that after 40% plus growth in business finance originations over the last 2 years, that's plateauing slightly. We feel as though we can instigate another level of growth through better processes and a better customer experience when it comes to SME lending, and we learned quite a bit through the motor project. We've spoken about the capital base and our access to TFSME with its 10 basis points cost of funding. We'll continue to invest, and we do feel when we do refocus our strategies over the latter part of this year, the prime proposition is ready to push on again. The bridging market you've heard from Robert, I think we're really forging a presence in that space. And I do believe that opportunities will arise through fewer competitors in the marketplace, opportunities for us to diversify, and I also think there'll be some market consolidation as well. I wasn't going to spend too long on slide 17. The strengths of our business model are there to see in our ability to continuing to operate successfully through this crisis. But a number of those can't be stressed enough at times like this. Things such as a board and management team who have seen several recessions, operated through a collection environment that's obviously going to be quite tricky, and come out with a business that's strong at the end of the day and in a position to take the opportunities as they arise. So just to summarise, we've proved resilient, we're continuing to operate, we're limiting the effects of COVID-19 on business. It's difficult at the moment to, with any certainty, estimate the effects on the collectability of our portfolio, but I would stress that those forbearance cases in the majority to good paying customers, 96-97% of our book is up to date, so there is no reason why you wouldn't be wanting to help those people. So the sooner we see some economic activity, the sooner those SMEs can recover. We had strong portfolio growth ahead of the crisis. Our results have been hit by a COVID impairment charge of 1.6 million, as you've seen. So many of our KPIs, which you've measured us against in the past, are down. But we will continue to focus on those, and we'll reset those in the near future. We've got a successful track record through previous credit cycles. We've entered this in as good a position as possible with a strong capital and liquidity position, and where our intention is, following the disruption, to come out of this in the best possible conditions to take advantage of the opportunities as they arise. So I believe there's no doubt this is disruptive to the whole of the UK, banks and companies, and our results will reflect that over the course of this year. But I still believe there's substantial opportunity for us to grow as the UK recovers and as we embark back on our original growth strategy that we've had in the previous 2 years. So I was going to leave it there, open up for questions. There's several appendices which we weren't going to go through, but if you've got questions on the income statement specifically or the balance sheet or any of the more granular sides on portfolio analysis and credit quality, we'll be happy to take those. Or more generally, just outlook questions and questions on the presentation today. So let me hand over to Ed, who I think is going to facilitate the questions.
Thank you. If you do wish to ask a question, please press 01 on your telephone keypads. If you wish to withdraw your question, you may do so by pressing 02 to cancel. There will now be a brief pause while questions are being registered. And our first question comes from the line of Vivek Raja of Shore Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Hi. Good morning, guys. Thank you for the presentation. I just want to explore the quality of the loan book. And I appreciate, thank you for the disclosure on the IFRS 9 impairment overlay. Obviously, I don't understand exactly what you've assumed there in terms of asset value fall. So the first question is, what proportion of the loan book is in the highest LTV bands? And I leave that to you to interpret in terms of what I mean by high LTV bands. I see obviously that as forgetting about collections, that as the obvious risk. And then sort of connected to that, what are you thinking about secondhand car prices in the second half of the year? And, you know, whatever comments you can give to what you've applied in your IFRS 9 modelling with respect to that. That's what I wanted to know, please. Thank you.
David, perhaps as an IFRS 9 question, you're best to start on that, and then Robert and I can finish off on any other points.
Okay. I guess from just on the LTV point, our books, so bridging, for example, we only go up to 75% we loan at the end of the loan. So nothing is more than 75% at any point in time in bridging. Whereas on the other books, we would go potentially higher than 100%, but I think our overall average is just below 100% on LTV across those books. In terms of recovery rates, we looked at those, and of course the recovery rate is one input to what we calculate for our loss given default calculation in the IFRS 9 model. We looked at a couple of options in terms of reducing recovery rates by 20%, 10%, and 30%. So we looked at those options, and that's the kind of ballpark reduction in values that we've modelled. Don't want to be too specific there, but you know, we're talking about a blended rate across those numbers.
Okay, thanks.
I would just add that we were able to look at those recovery rates as well, and the performance of the book against previous experience in the global financial crisis, where we saw similar falls in recovery rates and asset values. So we've been able to borrow on behavioural performances of past recessions, And I guess that's one of the strengths of the business. I focused on the management strength and the experience of collections, but it's also the experience of going through a downturn before. So I think a lot of our past experience can be built into our modelling when it comes to IFRS 9, which is a real strength.
Thanks very much. I wonder if you could comment on your view on car prices, please.
Shall I pick up on that one?
Robert, do you want to pick that up?
Yep. Yeah, sure. I think we've always been a used car lender, and I think we've been saying over the last couple of years, well, new car sales have been on a downward trend, whereas used car sales have been on an upward trend, that we feel in a more comfortable position than a lot of lenders. I think that's still true. And I think sort of the anecdotal evidence we're seeing at the moment and industry chat is that more people are going to start looking to buy cars now because of the reluctance to use public transport. And that demand is more likely to be in the used car than the new car market. Now, what that does to prices is hard to say, and the area where we don't have any real evidence is from auction prices. So we track what we achieve when we get vehicles back from customers through repossession, what we sell them for at auction versus the CAT trade value. But the auction houses have been closed until the beginning of this week. So they've probably been closed for 6 to 8 weeks. So we haven't been in a position where we've had any statistics to show what's going on in the market. I attended a webinar in April where prices at that time were pretty stagnant. They weren't going up or down. So it's hard to say, Vivek, really. I think it'll come out over the next 2 months, but as I said at the outset, I think the important thing is, as a used car lender, I think we're in the best position than those that are new car lenders, and certainly those who are in the PCP market and are now sitting on vehicles coming back and probably being significantly underwater.
Okay, what portion of your dealers are actually trading at the moment? How many of them have sort of closed up for COVID-19, and how many of them have sort of remained trading?
Don't necessarily have a statistic for you on that. What I can tell you is that during April and May, we saw quite a flow of business for customers who had agreements with other funders with a balloon payment. And the balloon was set at a level where it was an attractive lend for us in terms of current LTVs. And we saw that as quite a rich scene of business, because you had a customer who already had the vehicle, wanted to clear a balloon with a sub-100% LTV. They'd been paying for the vehicle for 3 years, and the new instalments were less than they were paying before. And they were in our top two credit grades. So that was a sort of a niche of business that we found quite attractive during the last 2 months. Dealerships are starting to open. So some of our brokers, particularly on the consumer finance side, as some of the dealerships were closing in March and April, the brokers effectively closed down. But they're all back in business now, and I think the opening of car dealerships this week will probably give an impetus to that sector.
Okay, that's very helpful. Thank you. Forgive me for asking one follow-up question. David, when you talk about the LTVs, the 100% across the books, ex-bridging, can you just remind us your basis for calculating LTVs? I think that's quite important.
Yes, so when we talk about an LTV, we're comparing to the trade price that we get from Capital Glasses Guide against the capital balance or the loan that we first lent them at the start. I mean, obviously now, as an average across the book, you would expect it to be slightly lower. that typically the loan is paid off quicker than the value of the asset drops. Of course, that may well be corrected with the slight reduction in recovery rates just now.
Okay. And to get a sense of the price to the sort of end consumer, what is the sort of typical markup on that trade value?
It depends on the vehicle, Vivek. And one of the things that's interesting is it depends on the ticket size.
Right.
So you may well have a dealer who has an approach of, I want to make a profit of £2,000 on every car.
Yep.
If you say that £2,000 is the difference between trade and retail, you can see how the percentage would be different if you had a car which had a retail value of £6,000 and a trade value of £4,000 versus a car that's got a retail value of £25,000 and a trade value of £23,000. So we find some unusually high LTVs on low value vehicles, but the actual pound risk is relatively small.
Right. Okay.
So to give you an example, if I said, well, a car retails at £6,000, the customer puts in a £1,000 deposit, and the trade value is £4,000. That is a 125% LTV, but the risk is actually only £1,000.
Okay.
And what you would find is that a vehicle of that ticket size would probably only be financed over 3 years, and so that LTV risk of £1,000 would diminish quite quickly.
Yeah,
because the customer would repay the money faster than the car depreciates.
Okay, I guess, I mean, what I'm pushing for, which it sounds like you're not able to give, is what that 100% means if you assess that value based on, you know, what you could actually ultimately realize in the market at that, in a normal market, you know, the retail price. That's what I'm asking. I appreciate you're saying that it depends on the credit in each given circumstance, and you're not able to sort of provide a rule of thumb on that.
Can you just ask the question again, just so I'm clear what you're...
Yeah, so your 100% LTV is based obviously on the trade price, and that I suppose is in principle what you would have if you had to repossess the car. You could ultimately realise in the trade market. What I'm trying to work out is if you could give a blend of that 100%. What does that mean in terms of the retail price? But I appreciate you've said that, you know, it depends on credit by credit, but can you give a sort of sense of what that 100% is on a retail value?
Well, I guess if you looked at those two examples that I gave, if we were to lend £100,000 LTV on the first example of a car retailing at £6,000 but having a trade value of £4,000, the customer would be paying a deposit of £2,000.
Yeah.
But
sorry,
if it was...
Robert, forgive me, I understand that, but I'm asking if you could just give a sense of where you think it has been, where it is at March across the overall book.
No, we don't have that figure.
Okay. Okay, that's me. Apologies for asking so many questions, and thank you very much for taking the
time.
Fine.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Robert Sage of Peel Hunt. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Yes, good morning, and thanks very much for the presentation. I have two questions. The first is on the net interest margin, and I hear what you say in terms of further erosion of the margin is likely going forwards. I was just wondering whether you could comment on the likely trajectory of the margin. Do you expect it to continue to decline at roughly the same rate as we've seen in the last 6 months, or do you expect that to slow down? The second entirely unconnected question is just looking at the COVID-19 provisions and the capital ratio, which I think you're quoting at 17%. Have you been able to claim transitional relief for the COVID-19 provision?
Okay. Shall I ask? Thanks for that, Robert.
Yep, please do.
So the COVID-19 19 impairment is unfortunately there's no transition available, although IFRS 9 as an accounting standard has got transitional rules attached to it. There's nothing specific that we can get regarding the COVID-19, unfortunately. In terms of the NIM, I would say NIM to some extent is a factor of how much of our book is in prime. And as we've said, our prime new business percentages have been in the 80%, and we're targeting 90% or more going forward. So by that mere fact, you'd expect NIM to come down. But I don't, because we are circa 75% prime already, I wouldn't expect NIM to come down as markedly as it has done in the last couple of years. So we should start to see in the next probably year to 18 months a bottoming out of that NIM, and operational gearing starting to kick in as we grow the book post the fallout of the COVID-19 pandemic.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Ray Mail of Panmure Gordon. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
Morning. Just picking up from Robert's question about the NIM, obviously the improvement in the underlying impairment charge that we saw in the first half, presumably you would have expected that to be trending lower as well to match up against the lower NIM. Is that a fair view? All of the first
NIM,
equal, of course.
Yeah.
Any view on where in normal circumstances you might have expected that otherwise to have gone towards?
I think it's a difficult one, but if you looked at our previous results, and we've talked about maybe 70 basis points as being something that was our kind of benign impairment cost of risk charge. But I'd certainly say because of our split of prime increasing, you would expect 70 to become 60 or even 50 basis points. But that's slightly crystal ball viewing, because what is a benign market? I don't think we'll be seeing one for a couple of years. But nonetheless, I think from a purist point of view, I expected that to come down by 10 or 20 basis points from what we saw previously.
Okay, thanks. And can I pick
thanks,
up on
David.
Some of the...
Ray, I might... Yep.
Sorry, Scott, carry on.
I was just going to add to that, Ray,
I'll let you go, Scott. How about that?
I was only going to add that I think Vivek was touching on the same point here, that there's a combination of things in that fall in impairment charge. I think David's right to sort of signal the direction of that charge. There's the credit quality which will lead to it as well, but I think over the shorter term we are going to see some pressure on asset prices. And of course a collection strategy is about can be, should a customer default, is about getting the vehicle back. So as long as you're forecasting less than trade in a normal market, which we do, you should cover the balance of the vehicle. And in the cases where the vehicle hasn't been well looked after and it doesn't achieve trade value in a distressed sales situation, you have the customer fall back on as well. So it depends. That can be a slightly longer play. And as we saw over the global financial crisis, can take a number of years to collect out that money, but we have a very successful track record of getting in excess of 75% of anything that's left on any balances back from our customers.
great. I suppose following on from that then, I mean, in the forbearance which you've been granting to date, I mean, have there been any particular pockets of demand for forbearance, or has it been pretty widespread across the book?
Perhaps, Robert, you could take that.
Yeah, it's been pretty widespread across the book. There are obviously certain areas that it affects more than others, and you can see that within our own divisional statistics, and Azul has the highest level of, or the highest percentage of its portfolio being forborne, because that is the sector which really has been hit very hard. If you looked within the business finance arena, certainly coach and bus has been one that we've seen greater incidences, or I guess of all of our coach and bus customers, there's been a high percentage that have asked for forbearance simply because they've not been able to operate, and when they are able to operate, they've got social distancing issues to contend with as well. So those are the two that immediately come to mind. What I would say is we were quite surprised that we saw some of our longest standing and what we would classify as our best customers come to us for forbearance. But equally, we saw some fairly new businesses be able to survive without having to ask for a request. This is a real curate's egg.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Neil Gordon of Investec. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Yeah, morning. It's Ian from Investec here. One comment, really, and then two questions. Just on the earlier discussion around the reopening of car showrooms, I was at a couple of dealers yesterday and it's absolutely buzzing. The only problem they had was a lack of stock, given the interruptions at the auction houses and retail punters bringing in cars for sale. But hopefully that's a good sign of how things will evolve. My question, I wondered if you could just say something about the materiality of your use of the furlough scheme. Is that, for example, sufficient to offset frictional costs of dealing with people working from home, i.e. might we think of costs as perhaps being broadly flattish half and half looking into the second half? And then secondly, just coming back to the COVID-19 overlay on impairments, can you just say something about your high-level macro assumptions around unemployment and GDP, just to give some context in terms of the absolute number? Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Neil. Perhaps if I take the first part, and then I defer to David on anything IFRS 9. not going to get into those discussions. The first one on furloughing and costs, it's a good point. I think we will probably find it difficult to see our cost-to-income ratio continue to fall in the second half. Certainly, furloughing costs won't offset the costs in the business. And that's partly because we have remained open for business across all areas, so service levels are important, but also we've redeployed staff within the organisation to make sure that customers that are under stress as far as requiring forbearance have a good experience with us as well, and we don't make troubled times like this even worse for them. So those staff who would normally maybe producing income to the top line are there protecting and safeguarding the assets. And I think the other reason why we will find it a little hard in the second half to continue to bring that down is, of course, we were very much gearing up for continued strong growth. You've seen the last 2 years and our first 2 years as operation as a bank. We've put a lot of resource, increased staff numbers, put quite a bit of money into infrastructure as well, premises as well. We've increased our premises size. All of those things were put in place pandemic. So we've got to, in some ways, we've got to live within that cost base for a little while until we can get back onto that growth path.
Thank you.
David?
Looking at my statistics, which So in terms of our macroeconomic curves, as you say, we have four that we look at: CPI, unemployment, GDP, and the used car price index, which is part of the CPI sort of a bucket of indexes. I think what we considered on the GDP a significant drop, and I think it's something like 20% or so in the first quarter after March, and then it starts to the curve starts to come slightly back towards the end of the year. I think unemployment rates, we looked at stressing that out to about 8% as a pessimistic level. And so these sort of significant changes from what was previously, so doubling unemployment, significant reduction in GDP, has had that, contributed quite a lot to that 1.6 million. Of our impairment charge.
Okay, great. That's helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of Rob Sanders of Shore Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is now open.
All right. Good morning. Can you hear me?
Hi, Rob.
Yep. Okay. Quickly, I have to say the business is in much better shape now than it was in 2012 when I first started analysing you. And I think you're in a much better position to gain market share as you leave this crisis. The key questions are, what's happening with the competition? And you've touched upon it in the statement about potential M&A. Which areas do you think you would like to get into? Is it more of the same or is it a new leg?
Okay, perhaps if I take that. Thanks, Rob. Hope you're well. I think there will be fewer participants. I think it's amplified probably most in the bridging finance area at the moment. Anyone that doesn't have a banking model and access to liquidity is obviously struggling at the moment. That will leave them as a shadow of their former self, I think, if that goes on for any length of time. And not just the strength of that business coming out of this, it's also our ability to get in with the introducers of that market and make part of that market our own. So I think there's some real opportunity there. I think also the fact that some of these businesses will be in a weaker position will allow for some consolidation. So that would, for us, that would fall along our normal business lines, because we'd feel most comfortable with perhaps a portfolio acquisition in areas that we already operate in. But we will continue to look for diversification targets as well. I think one of the strengths of our model, and one of the reasons that you touched on that we are stronger as a business, is certainly the access to funding in the retail deposit market, but it's also the more diversified balance sheet that we had. I know myself that there have been a number of people looking at our asset classes, and some people have positive and others have negative views on the motor sector, but it looks like being probably the more resilient part of the book coming through this crisis. So when a lot of people probably saw a really strong future in SME lending in the UK, having a balanced portfolio with all those areas has been a real strength for us. So I think M&A in another business line related to either consumers or SME, and I'm not picking anyone out in particular, I think it will come down to the opportunity. And what we always say with an acquisition, it's about the people. People who buy into our strategy, our story, and have a real knowledge of their business sector is what's really attractive to us.
Just to follow on, Rob, with what Scott just said. I guess from my perspective, the question you asked was what's happening with the competition. I think the majority of banks like ourselves have tightened credit, reduced LTV, tried to up rates, because in some areas there's probably more demand than there is supply. And the supply has predominantly gone from the independents, and that would be both in business finance, well, across three pieces really. Business finance, where the independent finance companies in the way that PCF was pre-banking license, who use block discounting as a means of funding, and they've been very severely restricted over the last 2 months by those lenders. Some of the competition, independent competition in the consumer car finance market, who are backed by very large bank facilities, they've pulled out of the market. And then, as I mentioned earlier, in the bridging market, in particular, we've seen withdrawal from the market of non-bank funded lenders who typically use high net worth individuals to fund their business. So that creates opportunity across all of them. I think it also, what it does do is highlight what a good move it was for us to get a banking license, to insulate ourselves from that funding risk that we always identified back in 2011-12, that if you put yourself at the mercy of one funder, you have a risk that you can be out of the market before you know it. And then on top of that, as a bank, you've got we now have the advantage of the term funding scheme, which we'll certainly be using over the coming months, which is a great source of funding for us at a very, very cheap rate, and will probably help our NIM a bit over the next year.
Yeah. Okay, that's been great. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Our next question comes from the line of James Fletcher of Cenkos. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Morning, gents. Just two quick ones from me, just on the business finance division specifically. Just appreciate there's a lot of looking into crystal balls here in its early days, but just from your actual team speaking with customers, can you give us a bit of colour just on, in terms of those customers in forbearance, just how permanent this feels? Do they feel like they've got models which are permanently challenged in the new world, or this is just effective lockdown? And then secondly, just on kind of government intervention and things like bounce back loans, do you think that has helped perhaps some of your customers in terms of either accessing cheaper finance or just accessing finance to pay your current loans back at all? Have you seen any impact there?
Very good questions, James. I should answer them, but in terms of forbearance, we're in a very interesting period now because we have, as I said, we had our initial request coming in early mid-March, and they were fairly like two or three a day at that point, but then of course it built up progressively. So we have a number of customers who are going to be coming to us possibly in the next 4 to 6 weeks asking for an extension of that moratorium. And we've had a couple already, as I mentioned, coach and bus. There are people that just said, look, my coaches are still parked outside and I can't use them, so can I extend? The imponderables for us are multifaceted. So we don't know how many people who approached us in March then went on to get C-bills or bounce back loans, which will tide them over without the need to come back for a second moratorium. We don't know how many of them have really got their feet back on the ground and don't need a moratorium. So it's a tough one to answer, really. I guess it's one of those ones that maybe in 2 months' time we'd be able to give you a really clearer picture on it.
Yeah, fair enough.
We were going into uncharted territory 3 months ago. I think that it's just as uncharted at the moment as to how those forbearance requests will play out.
Yeah.
The other thing is that what we have found is that a lot of people who got in early were doing it not because they were desperate for cash flow benefit, but more as a matter of prudence.
Mm-hmm.
So to give you some anecdotal evidence, we have had customers come back to us and say, oh, I'm now thinking of buying a new vehicle or a new machine. Would you fund it? And we've given them the forbearance in April. And we've had a policy where we just say, well, we can't because, you know, we can't give you forbearance on the one hand.
Yeah.
And some of them have come back with, well, I only asked for forbearance because, like, the world was falling apart at the end of March. And I just thought I have to protect my business. So I'll get whatever help I can. And obviously there was a lot of media attention that time into what the FCA and what banks were doing in terms of forbearance. So I think a lot of people probably got on the bandwagon and thought, well, if it's there, I'm going to take advantage of this opportunity. So some of it was not desperation. It was more prudence.
Yep. That's good. Excellent.
I'm sorry, it doesn't really answer your question.
No. It's just an early stage. I appreciate
it. It's one of those things. We just don't know how it plays out, and that's why we've had to make this IFRS and PMA.
Yep. Thank you.
Thank you. Our last question comes from the line of Vivek Raja of Shore Capital. Please go ahead. Your line is open.
Hi, Jeff. Sorry, me again. I just wanted to tie up your useful comments on competition with your earlier comments on net interest margin. So I guess looking over the last couple of years, the squeeze on net interest margin has been largely about the shift in mix as you improve quality of lending, offset partially by funding costs. So if I could sort of separate that into two parts then. So there's also, on top of that, being competition in some of the segments you operate in. I mean, for example, you know, prime consumer, before you sort of got into it, was an area of quite some competition. So what I'm asking is, you've already talked about bridging where there's been some, presumed, less up in competition. And the question is that feeding through to price that you think you can achieve on new lending? You sort of intimated the same thing on business finance, although I appreciate the focus of lending isn't likely to be there in the second half of the near term. On consumer, what are you seeing in terms of the asset yields you can achieve compared to what you would have been doing last year? And then on the other side of the balance sheet, on funding, since the base rate cut, what sort of savings have you been able to achieve on sort of similar tenor deposits? Thank you.
Should I pick up the lending one, Scott, quickly?
Yep, sure.
I think pricing is a combination of two factors at the moment, Vivek. So we are inching our pricing up on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And the two factors are, one, supply and demand. So as I said, there's less supply in the market, and so we feel there's an opportunity to increase rate. The other one, I think, is just the cost of risk in this current environment should be going up anyway. Mm. And I think that's an argument that most of our brokers understand. At a time when banks are all making pretty hefty impairment charges, and they foresee credit environment tightening, now is the time to be putting up your rates. So I think to answer your question,
David, did you pick up?
Yes, we are seeing it, and we are actively managing our rates of return and pushing them upwards.
And that's across the book.
Yes, it is. Yep.
Okay. Thanks.
I was so engrossed with Robert's response.
Forgot the question.
Sorry, the question was the other side of the NIM impact for the funding. So since the base rate cut, what are the savings made on deposits?
Yeah, so I suppose definitely having looked in the market, and I think you'll all see it yourself, we've seen the one-year rate for deposits come down for what was pre-crisis touching nearly 2% to now I think it's more 125 basis points. 130. So there is a significant drop, more than perhaps the base rate drop we're seeing. So there's just that real drop in the market, and we've seen particularly when you go to market on a rate within a few days, the market's moved typically downwards. So I would say of new money, you're looking at 50 to 75 basis points reduction in cost, which is a blend. Won't have a huge impact on our NIM, but it obviously will show a reduction as time goes on.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And there are no further questions on the line, so I'll hand back to our speakers for closing comments.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you very much. And thank you, everyone. Thank you for your questions. A really good range of questions. Again, I will send you through the course presentation that we're open business and we're resilient. We're in a good position, as good a position as we could have been entering this crisis. It's frustrating for us all that it's blown us off lightly after having several consecutive impressive years of growth post-banking license, but I have confidence that we'll return to that in the not too distant future. I hope this format works for you. It'll talk more with the love of that face-to-face as we normally do. Good. Anyone have any follow-up questions, please call those through. Just I'll be happy together and more than happy to provide any information, follow-on information that you'd like. So take care, everyone, and we hope to see you all again soon. Thank you.
This now concludes our call. Thank you for attending. Participants, you may disconnect your lines.